The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Court Appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Dr. Lawyer, Indian Chief. For my life with songs of grief, with the yellow fear and fearless eyes. His temper all the times I try.
See Dude's Perspective on Legal Philosophy. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer dude and a judge.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am still just a dude.
I should have added, I'm also a bearded hermit living in my house, not leaving for any reason.
Yeah, that beard has got to be adding about 10 pounds to you and make it hard to, like, turn around in a small room.
Well, it's funny because you hadn't seen me in, I guess it's been maybe 2 weeks now.
Yeah, maybe even three, because I think we recorded on time, and then we didn't record for two, well, we recorded remotely, but we haven't recorded two other weeks, so it's probably been three.
Yeah, but actually, whenever you said that, I kind of looked at my beard and took a real self-accountability check, and yeah, it is pretty burly.
Yeah, it's like looking up a tunnel to see your mouth. A furry tunnel. I don't ever want to get caught in a furry tunnel.
No, I don't think so. Probably not
a good thing. Especially one waiting with teeth at the other end.
Let's move on.
Okay.
What do you say about that?
So, you know what? I came across a little trivia fact that I thought was interesting in these pandemic days.
Oh yeah, what is this?
Well, it wasn't this exact date, but on April 18th, 1930, you know, you always hear people talk about us old folks always talk about the good old days when things used to be good and, you know, and all that. Well, there's one that I think falls under the good old days. April 18th, 1930, said on April 18th, 1930, a reporter for the BBC came on for his 8:45 radio bulletin. He cleared his throat and reported that there was no news at all to report. He played piano music during the broadcast instead. Wouldn't it be great to have him come on and say, there's nothing new to report today?
Yeah, everything's fine. Continue on.
Yeah, we're just going to play some music for the 30 minutes that the news is on.
Yeah, I don't think we're ever going to go back to that time period.
No. But I just came across it, and I thought, damn, wouldn't that be something in this day and age if they said, no news, everything's great, just keep doing what you're doing?
You know, I would bet there actually probably was news somewhere that could have been reported, but just given the limitations and access to information, our friend there at the BBC didn't have the means to report it.
Well, I kind of theorized that he got drunk the night before, and so he came staggering in there and didn't do his job and didn't know where anything was and hadn't pulled up the paperwork. And he decided that's just what he'd do to get away with it, you know. Just say, oh, there's no news. I'm just going to turn on some piano music and then I'm going to start working on my hangover.
I think that's just you being a jaded boss thinking all employees are drunk all the time. That even played through with the My Brother and Me television show when – you offered one of them a beer, and they said,
Travis.
Sure. You offered Travis a beer, and he said, sure. You got him.
Oldest trick in the book, and you fell for it.
Well, legal work has changed quite a bit over the past month or so, much like a lot of people's jobs.
Illegal work, too.
Yeah, illegal work, too.
Because they've noted that crime is down during the pandemic.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if the crime is down or arrest for people for committing crimes is down.
Well, I think it's because they're more noticeable because everybody with any sense is inside where they're supposed to be, and the people running around out there at night might be the ones that you need to keep an eye on. So they're more noticeable. They're not blending in.
And everybody's wearing masks.
Yeah, that's true. So you can't tell the good guys from the bad guys.
Exactly. But we're at my firm, we have really no in-office appointments unless you have to do them. And communication is pretty much just on the telephone. We're doing it via email and video chat conferencing on some occasions. And a lot of the attorneys and staff are working from home as much as they can to try to limit time in the office, which is kind of, I think, what a lot of people are doing in this day and age. Now, we're under, I guess, a situation where we're not like you have to stay at home, but you can go to work if you're an essential employee. And my business was deemed an essential business, as was yours.
Exactly. Because we're essential personnel.
That's right. And if I'm essential personnel, that's kind of scary because, I don't know.
It's even scarier if it's me.
But just some kind of funny things that have popped up over this pandemic. You have to kind of laugh at the things you can because there's a lot of bad information out there. So you and I both have a friend who's an attorney in town, and he's also in the West Virginia House of Delegates.
Right. I know who you mean.
Yep. He's a great guy and a family friend. And on Facebook, he posted a picture of he and his partner dressed up in ties, and they were having lunch at their office, and they were standing at their front desk, like 6 feet apart or whatever. And I just so happened to see him at the stoplight on a Saturday the very next day. And I rolled down the window and I said, like, "Hey, Chad, how you doing? You know, what's going on?" And we were talking real briefly. I said, "Hey, before this light turns green, I have to ask you, are you still wearing ties and dress pants and dress clothes to the office every day?" Because he was dressed up in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And he said no. He said that he and his partner have decided instead of having casual Friday, they're going to have formal Friday where they would dress like normal just to try to make them feel better about themselves and have a little bit of a semblance of normality. So they were casual the rest of the time, but they're having formal Friday. I thought that was pretty funny.
It was Saturday Night Live. I don't know if you saw it or not, but it was all done via Zoom and stuff like that. There was a lot of it was about Zoom. They were all in their own separate locations and put it together. And Tom Hanks hosted from his house, which he sent in, you know, the video. They had him do his monologue and did that in. And he said, "This is the first time that I've been out of sweats in a month," or something like that. But it was pretty funny. They had one about a Zoom, people doing the Zoom call on there, and a couple of the characters were playing older people who don't quite understand how technology works. And, you know, the one girl carried her laptop into the bathroom with her and some things like that. So not realizing everyone was still watching.
Older people who don't understand how technology works. I feel like I'm kind of understanding that a little bit.
I understand it real well. Whenever something in mind I don't quite get, I go, "Riley, get in here and help me out."
we were gonna use Skype for our conferencing. You're like, "How about we just use FaceTime? That's easier."
Yeah, this Zoom is something else.
So all attorneys are pretty much affected by this litigation and transactional practices alike. So when I talk about transactional work, I'm talking about things like real estate closings, contracts, wills, power of attorney, a lot of things that have like they're document driven and have a notary, and the notary has to generally attest that the person signed the document in their presence. So that kind of has that need to have the person in the room with you so you can actually see that they do it. So there's a lot of issues for transactional work going on right now. There obviously is some issues with litigation too. I'm going to get into that into the second part of the show. But for the transactional stuff, you know, wills are one thing in particular that are very different than any other kind of legal document. A will generally is not valid unless there are, and this varies by state by state. I always qualify my explanations like this, but a will generally isn't valid unless two adult witnesses watch the actual person who made the will sign it. And the witnesses must know that the document is supposed to be a will, and they have to sign the document themselves. So these states all have these rules which say if somebody is going to have a will and you're going to execute it the way you're supposed to and have it be enforceable and the person's wishes followed out, you have to meet these certain criteria. And the problem is that if you have, say, a person who's making out their will, and you have two witnesses and you got a notary in there, and say you have an attorney in there too, that's five people. You're at your limit right there. You're not supposed to have any more people together at all than that.
Well, yeah, and they all got to be 6 feet apart too.
They do. You got to have a big conference room for that.
Yeah, I'll say. You go over and get in that corner, and you get in that corner. You stand up on the desk.
I read one article where they were actually, some attorneys down in Florida were doing this out in the street because that was the only place they had big enough where they could still be in the line of sight and watch people do it, but still stay away from each other enough.
That sounds kind of dirty when you say they watch people do it.
It does a little bit.
But couldn't they use FaceTime or Zoom or something like that and observe it like that? Or do they have to physically be there?
Well, a lot of states have laws that say they have to physically be there and be in the same room and watch them do it. Now, mm-hmm. there have been some changes.
Be in the same room and watch them do it. You keep talking dirty.
We're going to have trouble getting through this episode here.
If we have to keep watching people do it.
I don't even know what to say. You're putting words in my mouth.
No, I'm repeating what you said. I'm just, you know, glamorizing it.
Florida did actually pass a new law, but it has not taken effect yet, where you can not be in the same room and do it, I believe, via video conferencing. I don't know the exact particulars of it because I haven't really paid attention to it. But there was a recent law that you can change that. So some of the formalities in Florida, at least, have been changed. But they're not in effect yet. So
if you do it via video conferencing, isn't that porn? That's the same thing.
I don't know. One man's porn. One man's porn is another man's podcast.
Is another man's legal transaction.
So you have to ask yourself, why is there this extra level of formality and caution with wills when you really don't have that with any other kinds of documents like contracts, promissory notes, things like that? And the real reason for this is because by the time a will takes effect, when you actually need to read the document and see what it's supposed to say, the person who signed it's no longer around.
Yeah.
they can't say, hey, this is what I meant. So that's why it's very important to have these witnesses who can say, yes, we saw the person actually sign this will. They wanted this to be their will. They wanted it to be their final testament. And they weren't drunk or crazy at the time they did it. So that's why it's you have to have the very solemn will making and will signing process.
I understand. It's a very solemn and sobering experience.
And I made sure to choose my words very carefully so there was no innuendo whatsoever.
That's good. Because if you start telling clients you need to have them come in the room and you've got to watch while they do it, you're going to lose clients, I'm telling you. They're going to say, this guy's a pervert.
I don't think so. I really don't. Now, when you're talking about wills and signatures and things like that, it's important to put out the kind of possible common misconception that a notarized signature is the same thing as a witness signature. Because whenever you have a will, you have the two witnesses, and what the witnesses are doing is they're saying, hey, I watched this person sign the will. What the notary is doing is the notary is saying, I attest, well, they're basically an affidavit that the witnesses are saying that they watched the person sign it. So the witnesses are essentially putting together an affidavit saying they watched the person sign it. And that's called a self-proving affidavit.
Well, they're also attesting that the people that signed it are actually those people, aren't they?
Yeah, that too. Well, the notary usually checks all that too.
That's what I mean. The notary is guaranteeing that, guaranteeing that all the people that are on their signatures are in actuality those people.
Yeah. Now, there are a couple states that allow the will makers just to have their signature notarized rather than witnessed. But that's definitely the minority. I think Colorado and North Dakota might be the only ones. I guess that's because there's not that many people there. I don't know. But there's a lot of people in Colorado now. Everybody's running there to go smoke weed, I think. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, but, well, that would explain it then. No, you don't have anything left to pass on after you smoked all that weed. It all goes up in smoke. And in North Dakota, it's so cold, nobody has anything up there. It's frozen. Just ask Charlie Rogers.
He's
on our Facebook page. He used to be on there quite a bit. Now, he's not been on there as much lately. He's in North Dakota.
He's in North Dakota?
Yeah. Yeah, he tells me about it.
Hey, up there, Charlie Rogers in North Dakota. hope you're doing well up there. You're not too cold like Tommy seems to think.
Yeah, it is. It's cold.
There are certain requirements. Oh, go ahead.
That's all right. I was just going to say they only got two seasons, July and winter.
And there's mosquitoes in July, I think. Now, in order to be a witness, there are certain requirements for a will. If you are a beneficiary under the will, you can't be a witness because you might have some ulterior motives to be the witness there.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and you have to be an adult over the age of 18 to do it. And there's some different states have different requirements, but those are usually the two general ones that you have to meet. Now, there are some, and I've talked about this a little bit, and there are some states where unwitnessed wills can be valid. And those are what's called holographic wills. And these are wills which are written and signed by the person who passed away in their handwriting. And some states require that it's dated as well. So this is one way you can kind of circumvent having the witnesses. But you don't really want to rely on a holographic will because it may be accepted by the court. It may not. There's going to be a lot of dispute about whether or not it's the actual person's handwriting. Just things like that. So you don't want to rely on a holographic will if you can.
So there's not like any Princess Leia popping up going, "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi."
No, that is not what a holographic will is.
Oh, okay.
Now, when I was getting ready for this episode, I did come across this one really strange case that involved, I guess, what you might call as a holographic will. And it was a dispute over the estate of Warren Bradway. And there were a couple different documents after he passed away. So to give you a little bit of backstory, on June 28, 2001, Bradway was a Pennsylvania resident. And he signed a will naming his recognized life partner, Mark Coleman, as primary beneficiary and executor of his estate. Now, in 2004, so this is about 3 years later, Bradway and Coleman ended their relationship, and Bradway began a committed relationship with Kirsten Baylock. Now, on January 11th, 2006, so this is 2 years after they split, Coleman filed a certified life partner termination statement with the state of Pennsylvania, which officially terminated his relationship with Bradway. On that same day, Bradway wrote out in his own handwriting and using his own blood a one-page codicil, which is also known as an amendment, to the 2001 will, which named Baylock as his primary beneficiary and executor. Bradway moved out of the home in Philadelphia in 2011 and died unexpectedly in 2016. So this person wrote out the holographic will in their own handwriting and their own blood.
That seems a little dramatic. I mean, what's the purpose of that? And he didn't die till 5 years later, so he had plenty of time to do it the right way. He didn't have to do it in blood, write it out like that.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't do the first one that way. That was overly dramatic, I think. I don't know. But, I mean, you could prove that he wrote it. It's got to be in his handwriting. It's in his blood.
Well, here's even more. They actually had a trial on it. They presented a DNA expert who was able to match the blood on the codicil with Bradway's DNA, and also a handwriting expert who determined the handwriting on the codicil was Bradway's handwriting too. So, I mean, they had it going and coming. So,
man,
it's got to make you think. It's kind of strange. So Coleman actually opposed the motion and wanted to present evidence from two witnesses who would testify that there was no signature on the codicil. So they said that, hey, the signature wasn't valid. And I guess maybe the signature wasn't in blood or something like that. The facts don't exactly show what exactly took place. But Coleman, even though Coleman had this this defense to try to show that Baylock committed a fraud by adding the signature, the trial court ruled in Baylock's favor. And they provided that the court said that a document or writing not executed in compliance with the requirements for signing a will or codicil under the law will be treated as meeting the legal requirements if the proponent of the document establishes by clear and convincing evidence that the decedent intended the document to be writing, document or writing, to be the decedent's will or alteration of the will. So I guess the court felt that if you write it in your own blood, that that is probably a significant enough reason that this is what you want to do.
This was serious business. He wrote it in blood.
Yeah. But that did leave me. So if this person, think about this, this person added a signature to this document after they passed away in order to try to make it say, well, there's a signature on it too. It meets the criteria, right?
The Blaylock person added it to the guy's amendment, right?
Yes. That's what they were trying to say.
But, okay. So they were worried, oh, he did do this, but he didn't sign it. Right. So they're probably not going to accept this. So I'm going to try to forge his signature so they won't be questioned. But when it was in ink and the rest of it was in blood, that probably stood out like a sore thumb anyway.
Well, here's what I'm guessing. It didn't say it was in ink. I just think it'd have to be unless he kept around a vial of his ex-partner's blood.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, think about that. Like, that doesn't exactly match up. Like, yeah. I thought the facts of that were just crazy.
Well, I don't understand. You had plenty of time to just do a new will. You know, just get rid of that one and do a new one. You didn't have to be all dramatic and write it out in blood.
Yeah, I don't know. But, I mean, it did bolster it because it said, hey, I guess if you're going to write it in blood, you know, there's probably a good chance that you wanted this to be your will or your codicil.
Yeah, I mean, if you went home and you had an accident and you're bleeding to death and you don't think you're going to make it, then you grab a piece of paper and you write it down real fast. And do that so that somebody will know, hey, I forgot to change my will, so here, I'm changing it right now. And the only thing I have to write with is my blood and my finger, so I hope you can read this.
Now, I have another case that I came across, too, which shows the general formality that wills and execution of them has to be where you actually have to have these different things. And this is the McCool case. I just thought that was kind of neat, too, the name McCool.
You think he was related to, who was the one on Bad... What was the Jonah Hill movie, that first one there? Super Bad.
Oh, yeah.
McLovin. Yeah.
I haven't watched that in forever. That was a good movie.
That was hilarious.
This is a woman named Louise McCool. Mm-hmm. And on May 21st, 2008, she actually met with an attorney to make a change in her will 1 month after the death of her husband of 40 years. So her husband passed away. A week later, she said, you know what? Or a month later, she said, you know what? I better meet with my attorney and kind of make some changes. And so she met with the attorney. She discussed the changes she wanted with the attorney and gave him a handwritten note with the changes she wanted. And in the presence of the attorney, dictated the entire will to be prepared by the secretary. Then she left the office. She was going to have lunch nearby while the attorney and the secretary finished up typing up the will for her to come back and sign it. However, she died about 1 hour after leaving the attorney's office, and she never had the opportunity to review the draft will. And the court noted that while the draft substantially reflected her handwritten notes, there were a couple of discrepancies and some ambiguities, and that even though this was a will she had just dictated to an attorney, it wasn't going to hold up, and so it wasn't allowed into probate. So
wow. I can understand why they would say that. It would still need to be reviewed. It didn't have the witnesses and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, that's why you have to have, I think that case in particular shows the bright line definition between what you can have and what you can't have. I mean, there has to be a line somewhere, and that's where it is. So.
You just found it, dude.
Yeah, I think so.
Man.
I know. That was kind of an interesting case. Now, also the other thing, these are kind of transactional type legal differences and things that are going on during the pandemic, but a lot of the litigation has changed quite a bit too. And when I say litigation, I'm talking about in court and trials and things like that. So if you remember, we've talked about different parts of the trial process, and one of the most important parts is voir dire. And that is whenever you call in a large number of people and put them in a room together, and you ask them the questions to figure out who the jury is going to be before a case. Well, with our restrictions right now, you can't very well call a large amount of people into a room to ask them a bunch of questions.
No.
You can't even have 12 people sit together in a jury room because you're not supposed to have five.
Right.
So, I mean, how are you going to have 12 people together? So
you're not.
All jury
Zoom? You have to Zoom them.
All jury trials are pretty much not going on right now. That's just the way it is.
Well, don't you always have the choice between a jury or a judge?
Well,
you can just have a judge be your jury?
You can, but you generally have the right to a jury trial.
Right.
And there are certain cases that, well, I don't know. I mean, I think there might be some instances where you can have a bench trial and not a... well, I mean, I know you can have a bench trial in most cases, but there might be certain cases where you have to have a jury trial. But I don't know what they might be. There might be a few out there. I don't really know.
I mean, you could just say, there is no one that's my peer. You can't find 12 that are my peers. So you just have to have the judge. That's the only one on my level.
My mom said I was one of a kind. They broke the mold after they made me. So therefore, I can't have a jury of my peers.
That's right. I'm beyond normal. I'm AB normal.
I think it's our second Young Frankenstein reference in back-to-back shows. Now, there was one case that I was reading about, and they were actually on trial as this whole pandemic really kind of took center stage. And they picked a jury on Monday, March 9th, and it took all day for them to pick a jury. And the plaintiffs finished presenting their case on Wednesday, which would have been, what, the 11th. And that was the same time the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus to be a global pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
The lawyers, you know, nonetheless, were still focused on their trial. They'd already picked a jury, presented their case. On Thursday, the defense presented their case and closing arguments were made. And the case went to the jury at 4 p.m. on Thursday. That same day, which was March 12th, the Georgia Supreme Court asked people not to come to court. They said, all of us are being asked to do whatever we can to prevent the spread of this new virus. These steps, while inconvenient, are necessary at this time, and I believe are responsible actions. So the jury's gotten the case now. You've already completed the trial. They're just in deliberations. And now the Supreme Court saying, hey, don't come to court.
So wow.
They had some emergency hearings, and they were trying to figure out what they were going to do about how to limit these things. And state law in Georgia allows the chief judge of each circuit to declare a local judicial emergency and suspend jury trials or take other measures. But that judge went ahead and said, you know what? Since the jury's already got the case, I'm not going to suspend this jury trial. I'll suspend the other ones that are going on. But we'll let this one keep going, even though we're in the state of emergency now. And so that next day, that morning, the jury returned to the courthouse and they resumed deliberating. And they were worried that, hey, if this jury keeps deliberating much longer, what are we going to do? And that later that afternoon is when President Trump declared a national emergency to free up disaster relief funds. And the next day is when Governor Brian Kemp declared a statewide emergency there in Georgia. So, I mean, things are really starting to escalate now, and this jury is deliberating.
Mm-hmm.
But actually at lunchtime on that Friday, the jury returned with a verdict for the plaintiffs. And it was a pretty big number. It was $800,000 for past medical expenses, $250,000 for future medical expenses, $600,000 for past pain and suffering, and $1.125 million for future pain and suffering.
That's pretty big.
That's a big number.
Yeah.
And the jury put 10% of the fault to be the actual driver of the car who struck the plaintiff, and they had already settled the case, and 90% of the fault to be to the unidentified driver of a blue minivan who had done a U-turn, which actually caused the accident.
Mm-hmm.
So that person was never found. But the person who was the plaintiff in this case had what's called a UM policy. And I thought, I don't think we've talked about that before, have we?
No, I've never heard of that.
Okay.
That's an policy, huh?
An policy. And policies are pretty important. So before I get on this other issue, I thought the whole timing of that trial and the jury was kind of crazy.
Yeah.
So it makes you wonder, could you possibly appeal that and say, you know what, this jury, they were unduly influenced by the coronavirus and everything that was going on.
They rushed to a conclusion.
They rushed to get out of there. They had to get out of there. So I thought that might be an issue for appeal.
They were fearing for their lives. They thought they were stuck in a room to get the virus.
Exactly. So whenever you have a case like this, you have your own insurance policy, and that covers your property damage and things like that. And if you hit somebody else, your insurance policy is what they can go after for their damages.
Right.
Likewise, if someone hits you, you can go after their insurance to cover your damages. Now, what happens in the case where you have somebody who doesn't have insurance? That's where you have to have the UM policy, which is the underinsured or uninsured motorist policy.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a policy you get on your own for yourself. So if somebody causes an accident and they don't have insurance, or like this case, you never find them, then you can actually sue your own insurance company for your own coverage for your own policy like this.
Right. But there may be limits on whatever it is that you have.
Well, there are. Generally, your UM policy is for the same amount as whatever your other policy is for.
Right.
So if you have a $250,000 auto policy, then if you elect to get UM insurance as well, it'll usually be for $250,000 as well.
Right. So you're not going to collect that $2 or $3 million, whatever all that added up to.
Well, I mean, you can if you have that big of a policy. So this guy, right. This guy actually, in this case, I read, had a UM policy for $1 million.
Oh, okay. So he got $1 million, but he got a lot more than that in the award.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing. The insurance company only offered $25,000 to settle it before the trial.
Mm.
So there might be some bad faith issues there. And if there's bad faith issues, then you can generally recover more against the insurance company, especially when it's first party bad faith, when it's your own insurance company.
Yeah. Well, so, I don't know if you know this, but insurance companies try to make money.
Really?
Yeah.
I was unaware of this.
Yes, that's what they do. They try to make money. They love you as long as you pay your premiums. It's when you want something back. They don't think you're such a nice person.
How dare him?
I know.
Now, it's kind of interesting too, because if you have to actually elect to take a UM policy. You don't actually get that. So that's probably one of the most important policies you can get. But in some states, if there is not actually some sort of waiver where you say, I don't want UM, and there's not a signature where you're saying I don't want it, and the insurance company doesn't keep that in their file, then actually you get UM insurance because they can't prove that you didn't, that was offered to you.
Oh,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different loopholes and things like out there with regard to UM policies, but
mm-hmm.
I just thought that was kind of interesting that one case popped up during the middle of the pandemic, and it also brought up the UM policy, which I don't think we've talked about. So if you're out there and you don't have UM, go ahead and get a UM policy. It's a smart idea.
It's good. You were talking about wills and things like that, and I came across this thing that had to do with trusts. And trusts aren't wills exactly, but they're a form of legal document that you set up.
Yeah, they're an estate planning device.
There you go. And you have to watch somebody do it. So I found this interesting. At his death on April 17th, 1790, Benjamin Franklin left a dowry of £2,000 to be split evenly by the cities of Boston and Philadelphia, with the stipulation that it not be touched for 200 years. So by 1990, when those came due, by the power of compound interest, the dowry had ballooned to $6.5 million.
Wow.
The idea inspired, of all people, a lawyer, Jonathan Holden from New York, to make a similar bequest. So in 1936, Holden distributed $2.8 million into a series of trusts, one to the Unitarian Church, another to Hartwick College in New York, and a third to the state of Pennsylvania, in honor of Ben Franklin, who thought of this in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Each with a 500 or a 1,000-year lock on them. So he went beyond the 200 years. He went to 500 and 1,000. So they're payable in 2436 and 2936. And the problem is the amount that they will be worth then. So striking is the fact of what they would be worth that it would wreak total havoc upon the world. At such a rate of growth, Holden's trust would eventually overtake the global economy. By the 25th century, they would bankrupt the earth, and by the turn of the millennium, they would outvalue the known universe. The economy of 2936 would come crumbling down the day his trust was released, and Holden's dowry was a ticking time bomb. So in the interest of preventing economic Armageddon, a Pennsylvania judge voided Holden's compound rate in 1977. The trust would be allowed to accrue simple interest, but the gains could not be rolled back into the principal. So in 2936, therefore, Hartwick College will receive about $9 million, enough to fund a new lecture hall, but not enough to bankrupt the world.
I think it's bankrupt the universe.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the universe isn't bankrupt enough. But I found that unbelievable that a guy in 1936 did this and it was going to cause economic collapse to the world.
I know. That's crazy. Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Breeze.
Breeze. No, that might be off a little bit.
Yeah. I have to fine tune that.
So we talked about a bunch of different legal terms today. So we're going to be a little bit all over the board. But the first one is a holographic will. So help me, Tom One Kenobi. What is a holographic will?
Well, it has nothing to do with holograms. It has to do with a handwritten will that is written in your own handwriting. And it stands in place of other witnesses having been there to see it.
Yeah, that's right. It's in your own handwriting. And by the fact that it's in your own handwriting, it is deemed to be your intent for your last will.
Or your own blood.
Or your own blood in some cases. Although I don't recommend that. That's kind of gross.
Yeah.
Who can't be a witness to someone's will?
Who can't be? Oh, someone that's a benefactor from it.
That's right.
You're going to receive something from it, you can't be a witness because you might have something up your sleeve.
And that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
And we've talked about this before, but what is voir dire?
That's where you bring everybody in and you try to find out if they're on your side or the other one's side, or if they'll make a good jury person. So you can dismiss them if you don't want them.
It's not whether they're on your side or the other side. It's just if you think they'll be a good juror or not.
If they're going to vote your way, that's what makes them a good juror. Right?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. If you want to get right down to the meat of the subject.
And what is a UM policy and why is it important?
UM is underinsured motorist, and it's important because if they can't find who the other person was that caused the damage, then it's your own insurance that has to pay you.
That's right. And I think it's the most important policy you can have. So if you don't have one, go out and get one now.
That's right. Go right now. And if you don't know where to go, Michael's selling them. He's advertising for himself.
No, I'm not selling insurance. Although I need to get in that game. It's good work if you can get it.
Oh, I couldn't do that. That's a dying business, especially health insurance. Once the government takes it all over, what are all those people selling health insurance going to do?
I don't know.
That's a good question. They don't either. It's like being in print newspaper.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that's a dying business, too.
Yeah, it is. Although I do like to have a nice newspaper in front of me to sit and read.
I do, too, but it's getting thinner and thinner, it seems.
Yeah.
And it's like Mary says, it's not news, it's olds. Everything in there happened yesterday.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Dr. Lawyer Indian Chief.
We're proud to be coming to you almost live from Smurl Studios, high atop Three Last Mountain.
And we want to thank Audio Boom for being a part of their network.
And we also want to thank the McElroy Stable Podcast for helping give us our start. Their podcasts include Bim Bam, Sawbones, Still Buffering, and many other fine offerings.
If you have the chance, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you like us. And if you didn't, don't bother.
You're not supposed to say that.
You're going to edit that out, though, aren't you?
Why? You never did.
Thanks for listening. This has been Court Appointed. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude. Hello, and welcome to Tommy's Random Thought. Today's random thought is isolation. Well, we have all spent about a month in some type of isolation at this point. Other than paychecks not coming, the first week wasn't too bad. But now, well, some of us are going bat crap crazy. A couple of months ago, if someone said, "Wouldn't you like to just go somewhere and lock yourself away from the rest of the world and just take a break from everything?" most of us would be like, "Oh yeah, that would be so cool. I'd love to have an excuse to do that. Blah, blah, blah." Now I realize that it's not all it's cracked up to be. There is just too much sameness. I don't think humans are meant to be isolated from others for long periods of time. Look at what the worst punishment is in prison. Solitary. You have to stay in a cell by yourself, away from all the others. So think about that. You punish someone by saying you can't be out socializing with criminals of various ilk who may or may not want to shank you. And I said shank, not shag, so I'm not even going to go into that part of it. But if solitary is the most extreme form of prison punishment, then what does that say about not getting to associate with nice people? Or at least non-criminal ones? That you know of. Or at least they haven't been caught yet. But anyway, isolation is bad, right? We can't go out to a restaurant and sit down and have a nice meal. You can still, for the most part, either pick up or have delivered the same food to your house and eat with the same people that you would probably eat with. But somehow, not having the interaction with the staff and not having all the other patrons sitting around you in the same building makes the entire experience a lot less enjoyable. There is something to just being out and being around other people, even if you don't talk to them, that enhances these events. I think what it all comes down to is that basically we humans need to be with other humans. We don't like to admit it because we spend most of our lives complaining about other people. It's always other people that cause the problems. But really, we like having all those other people around. There is some type of security or satisfaction we get from being part of a bigger picture. Kind of like taking pride in being a part of a community that accomplishes something extraordinary, even if you didn't participate yourself. These are your people, part of your community, and you take pride in that, and maybe it makes you want to help out the next time. What that means is, being around other people makes us better people. If left to our own devices, well, that's where the darkness slips in. I think we all have a new appreciation for doctors and nurses after all this, but also grocery store workers. Did you ever think you would hear that grocery store workers are being called first responders and heroes? But what would we have done if all of them had said, screw it, I'm going home, I'm not taking any chances? Don't even get me started on the whole toilet paper debacle. But probably the biggest hero of all that has arisen from this is your kid's school teacher. When their education fell to us, I think most people failed. I think there was a large number of discussions that took place saying, you know, not everyone needs to go to college. I mean, someone's got to flip the burgers. So let's just not study today. It's hard, isn't it? Plus the fact the little bastards are home all day. When do you get a break? Am I right? So I think teachers will get a lot more than apples as gifts whenever everything goes back to normal. Speaking of normal, I think that will be changing as well. Some things I think we have discovered can be done better, and preparations for future events will change. It will all come back to this moment in time, this moment that the world stood still, and we were all a part of it in our own little isolation chambers, waiting for the all clear to sound. I think we will be cautious enough that when we hear it sound, we won't all run out and hug each other, but maybe just a smile and a nod, and maybe we will do a better job of acknowledging each other by being kinder and more helpful too. In general, we will appreciate each other more and understand that we are all part of the same crazy game, and like the atoms that make us up, we are inherently drawn together. This has been Tommy's Random Thought.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.